I'm Ruthie, and I have a recorder. Tune in Wednesdays from 4 to 5 to Out There. We'll meet people and plants around the streets and paths of Northampton, and we'll think about ways we can share the world. Here on Valley Free Radio, or archived online at weatherbeer.com/out there. Get out if you can, but if you can't get out, tune in. We don't care if they laugh at us. Let them take the bus and leave the sickle for us. They can have the Cadillac and T-1-2, but give me my rocket bicycle for two. Yep, it's Wednesday, July 19th. Thanks for tuning in to Out There today. Today's show, I have an interview with Carla Schaefer, who is a gardener at the Florence Community Gardens. I talked to her last night about her amazing garden plots and how lots of good gardening tips. And also, for the second half of the show, an interview with a woman named Stephanie, who stayed with us last week at my house. She came to us via Trust Roots, which is kind of like couch surfing, but more directed towards hitchhikers. And she talks about hitchhiking around Arizona, where she's from, and across the country, which is how she got to our house. Before I start the interview with Carla, though, I want to take a moment to share about some of what I've eaten today, because what did I eat today? It makes me feel this sense of gratitude for all my sources in the community. Let's see. First, for breakfast, I had this smoothie with a banana that a former house guest left, some grapes from the Aldi's dumpster, some cocoa and chai mix from a friend that I helped move out of her apartment, and some tofu that my friend Mark was getting rid of. Mark Beauvais, yeah, host of Table of Contents Fridays at 10 here on Valley Free Radio. Then after my smoothie, then I had some toast with some bread that showed up on our kitchen counter yesterday. None of the housemates know where it came from. Someone just dropped it off. And then there was some garlic sauce on the toast that my friend Marta had made and gave me a bag of on Saturday. And then there was butter on the toast. Now this butter, well, see, I came across this pint of heavy cream from High Lawn Farm. And this has happened a couple times in our fridge where someone has not wanted this cream, some of that cream, because it's out of date. And I put it in the fridge, and then I kind of forgot about it. And then 2 or 3 days later, I came back, and it had magically turned into butter. I didn't shake it or anything. It just, like, it was butter and very good. Then I left on my route. I went to East Hampton. I stopped in to say hi to my friend Eli, and he gave me some water and some apple rhubarb dense cake that he made. Thank you. That got me back to Northampton with my load. Oh, and then I also stopped to pick up compost. Petal People's doing compost pickup in East Hampton now, so I was on that route. And I stopped to pick up compost from Peter Williams. And the compost wasn't out, so I pulled up, and the garage door was open, and he was there looking at his bike, doing something on his bike. And he was like, oh, sorry, we forgot to put out the compost. And but before he went to get it, he was talking about his bike, and he was like, oh, I haven't ridden my bike all summer. And I was like, really? Well, what have you been doing? And he said, well, you see that picture on the wall? And there was a picture of him and the big blue sky. And he said, I'm a parasailing pilot. And so then we got to talking all about parasailing. I want to interview him for a show at some point. Because, you know, like, you can just carry your parasail on your back and, like, hike up to the top of the mountain. And then, I was going to say jump off, but Peter clarified, parasailers don't jump, they launch. You hike to the top of the mountain, then you launch off, and then you can, like, fly. It just seemed really amazing. Oh, anyway, yeah, so then he gave me food, too. Power bar, hibiscus tea. Anyway, oh, yeah, not to mention the cherries and a few more cherries that I found, and the apple on the Franklin Street tree. Anyway, thanks to all the people in nature that helped feed me. I appreciate it. All right, this is Carla from the Florence Organic Community Gardens on the corner of Meadow Street and Spring Street.
So we're at the Florence Community Gardens, and if you've ever wandered around the gardens, two of the amazing, most amazing plots you'll find are down towards the end of the road, towards the VFW. Is that what it is? On the left, well, you'll know when you see the green, lush jungle. What are your plot numbers?
My plot numbers are J31 and 32.
And this is Carla Schaefer. Carla, like, what's going on in your garden right now?
Well, it's interesting. I was just thinking the other day that this is really a time of radical transformation in my garden, visually, because, for example, I had grown tall trellised peas this spring, and they were so productive. They grew to be about 8 feet tall.
8 feet? How did you pick them?
Well, I couldn't actually reach the ones at the top. And they were still bearing peas, but I decided to take them out because they were making a bit too much shade for some things. And also, I wanted to harvest them while they were green so that I could add them to the compost pile as green matter.
The stalks. Your vines.
Because they hold a lot of nitrogen, and they'll bind with the compost and help to add nitrogen that'll make my compost break down faster.
How do you get peas that are 8 feet tall? Is it the variety? Is something you've done to the soil or what?
Yes, it's both. It's principally the variety, but I also start with a nice, rich soil that's been deeply prepared.
How deep?
Peas are heavy feeders. Oh, 24 inches. I double dig my beds, and it's taken me several years to do them.
You don't just bring out a ditch witch or something?
That's right. So I have an English spade and spading fork that I acquired when I was 18 years old, and they've been a part of my life ever since. They've traveled all over the world with me, and they've double dug many, many gardens. So they're one of my most treasured tools. And I do virtually all of my work with those. Once the beds are established from year to year, I'll use the broad fork more, and I won't have to double dig every year. But the soil is very loose. You can stick your hand down into the soil pretty easily up to your elbow.
Wow.
Without having to struggle too much.
So the roots can just go wherever they want and just...
Yes. Well, that does two things. One, it encourages the roots to go deeper into the ground, which means that they're more protected against drought. They get water from down deep where it stays wet longer. But the other thing is, because the roots are going down instead of spreading out at the top of the soil, you can plant things closer together. So you can plant more densely because there's plenty of nutrients when the roots can easily go deep. So one of the reasons that my garden looks so lush is because everything is planted very, very close. Mm-hmm. Not too close, because you don't want them to struggle for sunlight and nutrients. So I have pretty specific spacings that I like to use for each thing. So the peas came out this week, and that suddenly opened up the garden. Uh-huh. The other thing that happened was that I have beans that I've kept covered from the time that I planted them. I covered them with insect netting to keep off all of the little bugs that tend to wipe out beans when they're young and tender. But now the leaves are mature, they're tougher, they're not as attractive to bugs. And so we uncovered them this week, and so suddenly there's this nice green bean crop that's starting to blossom. And so that makes the garden look different.
I'm still thinking about what you said about spacing and the spacing being dependent on how much space, ground the roots have to get what they need. Mm-hmm. Hadn't really thought about that, because I look on the back of a seed packet and it says recommended spacing. I'm like, oh, that's it. That must be it.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's many variables.
There are quite a few variables. And the seed packets, of course, the seed companies are trying to provide information that'll be safe for every setting. Mm-hmm. And they really, the practices that most seed packets assume is the old-fashioned gardening where you have a pretty big area, you rototill, and you do long straight rows with enough space in between to run the rototiller down to cut the weeds. Mm-hmm. So that sort of semi-automated way that our grandparents used to grow gardens. Mm-hmm. But when I grow, instead of growing in single rows, I grow in beds. So there, I create little micro communities where the plants cover up the soil quickly, and so they keep the soil moist and keep the microbial life active right at the surface of the soil. And that helps to both hold nutrients that would otherwise wash away and also make them bioavailable to the plants.
So you said you've taken your spade all over the world. And so how have you always done this double digging style, or how did the transition happen in your lineage from your grandparents' style to your style?
Well, I first took an interest in gardening when I was about 17 years old. Of course, I had grown up working in our family gardens, particularly my grandfather's garden, which was always a great success in the old style. He was a great devotee of J.R.R. Rodale and the early organic movement. But I got a job at a publishing house way out in the boondocks of Northern California. And when I showed up on the job, it turned out that they had a garden associated with the grounds there, and the garden was magical. Mm-hmm. I had never seen anything like it. And it turned out that the gardener was a biodynamic gardener who had learned from a guy named Alan Chadwick, who kind of brought biodynamics to this country. So I knew right then that if I ever got serious about gardening, that's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so I read his work for a while, and a couple of other people. So yes, John Jevons is another author that talks about this method, and his books are still available. The most popular one is called How to Grow More Vegetables Than You Ever Thought Possible on Less Land Than You Can Imagine.
Mm-hmm. Which looks like precisely what you've done here.
That's sort of
my garden.
That's sort of what I'm aiming to do. But you know, I don't consider myself a polished, finished, expert gardener, and I learn so much from all the gardeners around.
Yeah, you learn what not to do from me?
Well, that's not entirely true. I've also learned some good things to do from my neighbors here. And I make many mistakes, too.
So I've had a lot of slugs or snails in my garden. I think you were like, you know what? All that cardboard there might be a little snail haven. I was like, last time I pulled up some cardboard, I'm like, whoa, I wish the ducks were here. I have a whole slug
really?
Farm.
Is that right?
There were so many slugs.
Oh, man.
There's slugs and snails.
Yeah. Interesting. I wondered if that might be going on.
Everything I plant is just like gone when I come back the next week. I was like, what happened to it? I thought I planted something. Is this even my plot?
Yes.
Can I pick someone else's plot?
Well, the thing about gardening is, you know, I like to plant lots of different things because there will always be some failures. I think no matter how expert a gardener you are, there are always going to be some failures every year just from the weather and things that are out of our control. And that's what makes it interesting, because you get to learn how to work with variables in a very complex system.
So you mentioned the biodynamic style of farming. For people who don't know, can you just mention some basic principles of that?
Mm-hmm. So biodynamics goes back to a German scientist named Rudolf Steiner, who lived and wrote in the middle 1800s, I think, if I am not mistaken. I could be wrong on that, but that's what seems right to me. He wrote extensively about, he was one of the first systems thinkers, really, about the relationship between the cosmos and the soil and the humans and the plants and the animals. And he focused on creating a self-sustaining closed system farm where you're not bringing in lots of inputs from outside in its ideal form. And you're working with nature. Some common features are people tend to plant by the moon. There are some formulas, some recipes for treatments that are commonly used in biodynamics. I don't actually adhere to all of those fine points, but I certainly have learned from biodynamics to think of my garden as an ecosystem and as a living thing, to focus on growing the soil. I think the whole concept of if you focus on growing good soil, you don't have to worry about the plants. The plants mm-hmm. will grow themselves.
Mm-hmm. What you said about Rudolf Steiner, I'm just thinking about, you know, the integration of the cosmos and the plants and animals and everything. I think of some Native American cultures as getting that.
Yes.
And so I like to say that, well, I guess I'm just kind of, how do I say it? Well, I'm wondering if this European man is given too much credit for things that people who've lived on the earth for centuries have already figured out.
Right. Yeah, I think there are a number of things to think about there. For one thing, Steiner, his methods were developed in Northern Europe and were very, very applicable to the traditional farming styles there. Mm-hmm. They have been successfully applied all over the world. But one reason is because the underlying principle is to connect with nature. So I think rather than being something that's exclusive to other forms of thought or pre-existing approaches, it's inclusive, saying, you know, whatever your learning trajectory or your culture or your history, successful gardening will have these components mm-hmm. to it.
So it's July, it's mid to late July. What's it time to do in the garden in Western yeah. Massachusetts now?
All right. Well, as I mentioned, I just pulled out those peas, and that left a whole bed of fresh dirt that, by the way, was so loose and wonderful mm-hmm. because the pea roots had made mm-hmm. it soft, and I didn't even have to dig it. So, and I have several other places in the garden where I've taken out early crops of greens and things that are kind of petering out now, and so I'm replanting new fall crops of mostly cutting greens. It's also a good time to plant fall brassicas like kale, and getting a little bit late for cabbage and broccoli and cauliflower now. So I would aim for the cutting type greens or chard, things that you'll be able to harvest early and be able to harvest for a few weeks before the frosts hit. Uh-huh. One thing you can do is look at your seed packets or your seed catalog, and look for the days to maturity, and then find your fall first frost date and back down the number of days to maturity. So, for example, I have, I was just thinking about my summer squash over there. I have a dwarf variety of summer squash that starts bearing in 21 days.
21 days from the time you plant the seed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
And it will bear for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks.
Wait, how is that possible? If you plant radishes, aren't radishes 21 days?
Yeah. It goes, they go really fast.
Where can other people get these seeds?
Oh, well, there are a number of places. I can't remember where I got
them. Okay, enough coveting my neighbor's seeds. Go on.
But just using that as an example, or carrots would be another example. Get the days to maturity. Maybe, maybe you have a 45-day carrot. Go backwards from your fall frost date, and then give yourself 2 weeks to harvest. Mm-hmm. And that can serve as a guideline for the latest planting date. It took me a while to realize, and I think a lot of people struggle with the concept of fall crops. And you read, oh, this is a good fall crop, and so you wait until August. Oh, fall crops. I should be planting fall crops now, right? But no, in fact, fall crops you can start planting right after solstice. That's the cue for gardeners, because that's when the day length starts shortening. And by the time even cool season crops mm-hmm. get to the point of maturity where they would start to bolt, it's likely, not promised, but likely that we'll be having cool enough weather uh-huh. that they'll be happy.
What are you calculating as the last frost date here at the Florence Gardens?
I believe that the date I have is September 20?
September 20.
I think so.
Is
that sound right to you?
Sounds kind of early to me, but that down here in this location, I think it may be a little earlier than my house on High Street.
It's pretty easy to find that information online, and you can, a lot of the seed catalogs, online seed catalogs, will have a link to a last frost date calculator, and or you can just look it up on the NOAA website, look for frost mm-hmm. dates, and they'll give you, there's a range, so depending on the percent likelihood of having a 32 degree frost or a killing mm-hmm. frost, which mm-hmm. is actually 20 degrees, mm-hmm. or a cool night that's cold enough to kill off your basil, which doesn't have to actually freeze mm-hmm. to die. So I usually pick the middle one, the 20-30% chance of having a killing, a 32-degree frost as my calculating date, okay. With the knowledge that it could be plus or minus by as much as a couple weeks.
Oh, yeah. I think Paige said, was talking about planting some fall crops, and she was saying, this is like a few days ago, and she was like 68, like she threw out the date September 15th or something, mm-hmm. September 16th.
Yeah. So I planted a new crop of peas mm-hmm. this week, a bush peas. I should be able to get a nice harvest from them. That's an example of a cool season crop mm-hmm. that I'm planting now, even though it's really hot. Carrots I've put in recently.
Do you have a plan for what you're going to put in when you pull your garlic?
Yes, I don't have a lot of garlic, but those will probably get more cutting greens, those areas. I'm also now beginning to think about my fall cover crops, because that's the other thing that you can put in right after summer solstice. If you have beds that you think you're not going to get around to planting, maybe it's a really busy summer for you, and you're finishing up your midsummer, some of your midsummer crops, and you don't want to do more successions for fall, think about putting in a crop of maybe oats or a mixture of oats and peas and vetch. And between now and mid-October or even November, they'll grow 30 inches tall. Oats are killed at 20 degrees. So they'll keep growing until we actually get a 20-degree night. So that's fairly late in our fall. Mm-hmm. And then they die. So you don't have to, come in the spring, you won't have to worry about, oh, I've got all this rye grass that's growing again. What am I going to do with it? Oats are great. You mm-hmm. put them in, they do their thing. Come springtime, you almost don't even have to till the ground. It'll be so crumbly mm-hmm. under that crop.
Do slugs like oats?
They don't.
All right. And they have a winner. Well, this is really great. It's really great information. Don't you do like a blog?
I do a blog. I just started it recently, and I've been posting about once a week. Can I email you the link to it later, and you can add it?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Anything else you want to add?
Just keep gardening. It's a learning process. We all make mistakes. I have some failures this summer too, but that's part of it's the journey, not the destination, that makes it so wonderful.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
That was an interview with Carla Schaefer, an experienced farmer and gardener. The interview was from yesterday at the Florence Community Gardens. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM in Northampton. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Here's some Luke Bryan.
daddy spent his life looking up at the sky. He cussed, kicked the dust, saying, son, it's way too dry. The clouds up in the city, the weatherman complains. But where I come from, rain is a good thing. Rain makes corn, corn makes whiskey, whiskey makes my baby feel a little frisky. Back roads are bogging up, my buddies pile up in my truck. We hunt our honeys down, we take them into town, start washing all our worries down the drain. Rain is a good thing. Ain't nothing like a kiss out back in the barn, wringing out our soaking clothes, riding out a thunderstorm. When the tin roof gets to talking, that's the best love we make. Yeah, where I come from, rain is a good thing. Rain makes corn, corn makes whiskey, whiskey makes my baby feel a little frisky. Back roads are bogging up, my buddies pile up in my truck. We hunt our honeys down, we take them into town, start washing all our worries down the drain. Rain is a good thing. Johnson does a little dance, creaks on the rise, roll up your pants. Country girls, they wanna cuddle, kids out playing in a big mud puddle. Rain makes corn, corn makes whiskey, whiskey makes my baby. Back roads are bogging up, my buddies pile up in my truck. We hunt our honeys down, we take them into town, start washing all our worries down the drain. It's a good thing. Rain is a good thing. Rain is a good thing. Rain is a good thing.
So for the next part of Out There, I have an interview with a house guest that we had at our house last week. All about hitchhiking.
So, Stephanie, oh, can you introduce yourself?
My name is Stephanie.
We met through Trust Roots, which is a couch surfing kind of organization. Can you say how you got involved or what you know about it?
Yeah, it's basically a couch surfing website for hitchhikers, kind of a network of people who hitchhike or travel alternatively who want to help each other out by hosting each other in our various cities around the world.
How long have you been part of it?
I joined 2 years ago.
Oh, wow. Do you know how old it is?
I think it's 2 or 3 years old.
Yeah. How did you find out about it initially?
It was advertised on HitchWiki. I think the creators of HitchWiki also started Trust Roots.
So. For listeners who don't know, what's HitchWiki?
It's a Wikipedia for hitchhikers. It basically catalogs everywhere in the world and tries to tell you, you know, the various laws on hitchhiking in different places, the best spots to leave from, that sort of thing.
So when people say a wiki, they mean like an online resource that anyone can edit. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. I'm still kind of learning these things.
Yeah.
When you came yesterday evening, we were talking with another guest of ours from Couchsurfing about hitchhiking. You hitchhiked here from Arizona?
I did, yeah.
And you were saying that you've actually hitchhiked quite a bit in Arizona and other places.
Yeah, I have hitchhiked all over the U.S. and in Europe and Israel.
Well, okay, so how did you get here yesterday?
So I was in Pittsfield. I was actually staying with another host from Trust Roots, and we had gone hiking. And then I hitchhiked. I got a ride to the edge of town. And then I put my thumb out basically just in a spot where there was a lot of shoulders so people could pull over. I think I waited maybe 5 minutes.
Wow.
And a guy pulled over who was going to the edge of the next town. He dropped me off. And then I waited maybe 15 minutes, similar scenario. And I got dropped off at a place called The Creamery, which is a co-op like between here. Yeah, in Covington. And this really cool woman who was eating there offered to give me a ride all the way. So,
and she dropped you off at our doorstep, right?
Yeah, she did. She did. It was raining, and she didn't want me to have to walk.
So you hitchhike a lot. Are you ever afraid?
Not usually. You know, sometimes if I haven't hitchhiked in a while, I sort of start remembering all the things that the stories people tell me, not individual experiences about hitchhiking, but kind of like, you know, my mom saying, "You're going to die," or, you know, the collective social consciousness, which says women shouldn't hitchhike. And sometimes that gets to me and makes me a little fearful. But whenever I get past that and start hitchhiking, it goes away because it's a totally different experience.
Do you think it's dangerous?
I don't think it's any more dangerous than any other activity. Involving other people, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For women in particular, like statistically, well, like most violence against women, like happens in the home or from people they know, and random violence from strangers. Do you know any statistics on that?
Yeah. No, the FBI came out with a study that said women are much more likely to be harmed by male members of their family than by anyone else. So that's husbands, boyfriends, fathers, etc.
So just don't hitchhike in your own hometown.
Yeah. So, you know, I saw the statistic and got to thinking about, you know, why is it that we're told to be afraid of violence when traveling and hitchhiking and, you know, being free and independent, but we're not told to be afraid of violence, you know, in the home, when we get married, when we're doing things that are conventional and often associated with dependence on men. To me, it feels like it's just a really clear narrative that has to do with controlling women. So, yeah.
When you first started to hitchhike, were you afraid?
A little bit. I had a lot of adrenaline. It was really exciting, I think. Not knowing what's going to happen. And I don't know. That went away pretty quickly. Yeah.
The very first time, did you go by yourself or with someone else?
I was with someone else. I actually... I was going to college at a town, maybe 2 hours from my house, and I was doing a rideshare home, and the woman who was driving, her car broke down, and there was another college student doing the rideshare, and we didn't want to sit there all afternoon on the side of the highway, get towed, you know, the whole thing. So I asked her if she wanted to hitchhike, and I didn't think she would say yes, but she did, so... So we walked out there, stuck out our thumbs, and this really, really cool woman from the Navajo Reservation pulled over, picked us up, dropped us right off where she needed to be. She was going to Phoenix to get a tattoo, had like 4 kids in the back. It was really cool, and it just felt, it was so obvious that there was nothing to be scared of. You know, she didn't mean us harm. She was such a wonderful person. And it's mostly been like that.
The resistance that you've felt, you said you felt some from your family or your mom. What about like the police, or where do you feel, who do you feel like seems to be most afraid on your behalf?
It varies. My mom is definitely really afraid. But my mom's also just generally really afraid of strangers and traveling, and she doesn't trust people. And I think with hitchhiking, you have to have a certain level of trust in humanity. definitely had police encounters where they've told me I'm going to die, I'm going to, you know, described the various terrible things that will happen to me, and then they've tried to prevent me from continuing to hitchhike, which is unfortunate.
You told one story about this, the truck stop. Tell that story.
Yeah, okay, so I was 19, and I wanted to do, with my best friend from high school, we wanted to hitchhike from Phoenix to San Diego. So we got a ride to a truck stop on the edge of Phoenix, and we weren't out there more than 5 minutes before two police came. They basically told us that we couldn't hitchhike, that, yeah, we were going to be put into a mass grave by the cartel, you know, like all kinds of stuff, to intimidating scare tactics. And it's not against the law in Arizona or in the town we were hitchhiking in. And I expressed that to the police officer, and he told me that he told me not to make him look up and find a law that we were breaking. You know, like he was going to find something to pin on us if we hitchhiked. And then he went into the truck stop, and he announced, he had them announce over like the radio to all the truckers not to pick us up. So it was kind of a damper on the beginning of a trip. We had to take a bus to the next county, and then we hitchhiked once we were out of his jurisdiction. So, yeah.
How many rides have you, would you say you've gotten over the years?
Ooh, hundreds. I don't know. Yeah. Definitely hundreds.
And so do you sometimes not take a ride that's offered?
Yes, all the time. Uh-huh. Yeah, I say no about maybe even 25% of the time, depending on the day. The way I do it is I basically have to feel 100% comfortable. And, if I don't, if I get some kind of bad vibe or if I'm just not sure, I say no, thank you. And I wait for someone I feel more sure about.
Do you ever feel like that person you said no, thank you to is going to circle around and harass you?
No, I mean, I usually hitchhike from pretty public places, so that helps.
So in my hitchhiking experiences, which is mostly in rural, semi-rural Tennessee, I'm just happy, excited if anyone stops for me. And it amazes me that you have options. Because I'm like, you know, I feel like my average wait time is, I don't know, half an hour to an hour, sometimes a couple hours. Yeah, so I'm just curious, like, what is the difference? Is it like presentation? Is it location? Is it time of day? Weather? Who knows?
I mean, it's probably a combination of all of those factors. I know, I mean, location's huge. Yeah. Definitely, you know, in some areas of southern Arizona where there's like no traffic, lots of border patrol, it's, I've waited hours for rides, yeah, you know, because there's just no one there.
Yeah.
So location's huge. You know, I was hitchhiking out of Portland and, you know, hundreds of cars were passing me, like constant traffic. I said no to four rides in a row. And then, you know, the fifth ride was perfect, you know. Uh-huh. And so definitely take that into consideration. But presentation also makes a difference. I mean, I know since I cut my hair, I have longer waits for rides.
Yeah, short.
Just having short hair. Yeah, instead of long hair.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of crazy.
Have you found that the people that stop for you, has any patterns in that? Like, are you more likely to, are you less likely to reject a ride with shorter hair? Like, are people less motivated by your sexiness or something?
You know, I've found that fewer mom and dad types stop. Like, I used to get a ton of rides from people who are just really concerned about my welfare. And they would say things like, I never pick up hitchhikers, but I had to stop because, you know, I was worried about who would stop for you if I didn't.
Yes.
You know,
I heard that a lot.
And I don't know if it's the short hair or if maybe because I'm getting a little older. I'm 25 now, so I don't look like a minor anymore, hopefully. And, you know, maybe a combination of those two things. But those people really don't stop for me anymore. almost ever.
But. Yeah. Have you, are there any highlights of bad experiences or good experiences that you want to share?
Okay, I can share some good experiences. One time I was hitchhiking in Israel with another woofer, which is like a farm volunteer. And we were going to this homestead for a wedding. And these two young guys picked us up and they were going to drop us off, you know, on the highway along the way. But they were going to the beach first and they asked if we wanted to come. And we said yes. And they drove like off the road around, like they knew back ways to get into this private beach that was super, mm-hmm. you know, like exclusive and expensive. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it was the bluest water I've ever seen. There were like ancient Roman ruins coming out of the water, and we went cliff diving. And then, you know, an hour later we were back on the road. Wow. That was a cool experience. And then once I was hitchhiking in Oregon trying to get from Eugene to Portland, and there was another hitchhiker on the road, this 20-year-old guy from Norway with a ukulele, and he had been out there a while. So we decided to try and hitchhike together because we were both going to Portland. And we got two rides in a row that both told us that we should check out Multnomah Falls, which is like this beautiful waterfall in Oregon. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've been there.
No.
Now. And, you know, we were looking at the map. We were saying, I don't know how we can get there. You know, it seems out of the way. It would be another day trip. You know, doesn't look like we can make it. And then the third ride picks us up. And it's this woman who hitchhiked throughout the 70s all over the country by herself. Now she lives not far from Multnomah Falls. And she invites us to come stay at her house, go hiking, cook an organic meal, meet her son. And then the next morning she drove us to Portland.
Wow.
So that was cool. Uh-huh. I have more stories, but I don't know.
How about hitchhiking in Arizona or near the border? Has that led to any experiences that you wouldn't have farther in the deeper in the United States?
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely had to deal with Border Patrol before, which is always fun.
Like what kind of interactions?
Mostly kind of neutral. They'll drive by, stop, ask. There are, in the Southwest, there are all of these, what I think are illegal Border Patrol stops, like not on the border, but just throughout the mm-hmm. South. Mm-hmm. And so if you're driving by, you have to slow to a stop. And you ask everyone if you're U.S. citizens. If anyone's suspicious, they might question them, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. And one time, a friend and I were hitchhiking north back to Phoenix. And this really sweet Mexican family picked us up. And we were in there, the back of their pickup. And, you know, we stop at the Border Patrol station. And, you know, the guy's questioning them and, you know, talking to them. And they say, you know, we don't know if the people in the back are U.S. citizens. So he comes up to us and asks, and, you know, we're talking to him. And he's never encountered hitchhikers before. Mm-hmm. He's very suspicious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was really refreshing because at the end of it, he turns to the family and he says, you be careful now. There are some dangerous people out there. And, you know, my friend was a woman, and usually that's what we hear from police yeah. and Border mm-hmm. Patrol. But he was, like, looking out for this family, and it was just kind of a reversal that was unexpected.
Mm. Yeah, I have this hitchhiking story that kind of reminds me of once I was hitchhiking out of Atlanta trying to get back to Kentucky. And this van, small van, pulls over. I had been on the side of the road for a long time, I feel like. And this van, it pulls over pretty quickly. There's two men, Hispanic-looking men in the front, and the man in the passenger seat jumps out. I had a folding bike and a bag. And he gets out pretty quickly, opens up the sliding door, and grabs my bike, and is like, I'm like, oh, thanks for stopping. I don't know if we were even talking Spanish at that point already or what. And so I got in. I was happy for the ride. And they seemed nice enough. And I got in, and there was two or three young people. I couldn't tell how young they were, like 14, 15, 16, 17, that looked, they were very quiet, brown skinned. I couldn't tell like their age, like if they were, they looked like they just come from somewhere else. Like if they're like malnourished or like if that like stunted growth or I didn't know what to make of the whole situation. Anyway, so the driver and the man in the passenger seat, they were both pretty friendly. I sat and I talked with them in Spanish for most of the time. And I tried to talk to the kids or the young people a little bit, and they were like, they just seemed like paralyzed with stress or something. And there was nothing in the van. Like I asked them, oh, where are you coming from? And they said, the beach. And I was like, there's nothing in here except for my backpack and my bicycle and a red, a plastic gas can. And, which later I determined was their pee jar. And anyway, I remember we got to Dalton, Georgia, and the driver said, we're going to stop here. And they were going to keep on going north towards Cincinnati. If you want to come stop with us, that's fine. Or we can let you off here and you can just keep hitchhiking. It'll just be a brief stop, he said. So we pulled off in Dalton, Georgia, and we drive into this completely nondescript residential neighborhood and pulled in the driveway behind this nondescript house. And everyone got out. And I remember one of the girls, I think there were two girls and a boy. I think one of the girls said something like, I haven't got out of the car in like 18 or 20 hours. And I was like, I think the beach is a little closer than that to Atlanta. And they went in the house and used the bathroom. And then there was a driver switch at that point. And the guy that had been in the passenger seat, he got in the driver's seat and invited me to sit in the passenger seat. And then we kept on driving. And they dropped me off. Like it was nighttime by the time they dropped me off, just right across the Kentucky border. And I gave him $20 and talked with him. Like I talked with him all. He said they were mom from Guatemala. And this was after this like hurricane landslide thing had gone through recently. And the whole situation, like, I was like, did they pick me up? Because like, I assumed they were like smuggling.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out, like, did they pick me up because that would be some kind of protection for them? Or, you know, could they, like, ransom me? Or did they pick me up because they know what it's like to give rides to people who need to get places?
Mm-hmm.
It was just such a mysterious,
yeah,
amazing experience.
For sure. No. Yeah, no, I haven't had anything like that.
Yeah.
That's cool, though.
Yeah, like when we were driving, the guys in front, they were talking on the phone a lot, and they were talking in mom. So I didn't, or that's what they said that they were talking in. So I didn't understand. Like I can understand Spanish a bit, but I didn't understand what they were talking about. But I kept overhearing like place names, like they're trying to coordinate something.
Yeah, yeah. I have a pretty good hitchhiking story. So, I was hitchhiking from D.C. to Philadelphia earlier this year. And, you know, I got a series of rides and they were all good. And I was dropped off in Delaware. And I was on the side of the road with my thumb out, kind of near a rest stop. And this truck pulls into the rest stop. And I wasn't sure if they were stopping for me or what. And then I see, you know, the woman get out and checking the engine. So she didn't even see me, but I recognized the truck from Standing Rock.
No way.
Yeah, it was like, it was this truck that had been like a landmark. You know, people are like, yeah, my tent's just right of the truck, the anti-Monsanto truck. It had this beautiful mural with like corn that had a skull and crossbones in it. And it says like Monsanto es muerto or something. And then the other side of the truck is like, stop all violence against women and children, you know, and it's a really cool truck, and it says No Dapple, and it's very distinct, right? Uh-huh. And so I had seen this truck for like over a month, and
when you were in Standing Rock,
yeah, and I had never interacted with the owner. I didn't know anything about her, but I just kind of felt like, I don't know. I mean, I have to walk up and mm-hmm. kind of find out. So I walked up, and it turned out that, the truck ran on veggie oil, and she was having some issues with it, and that's why she had stopped. But, like, I mean, she's like, oh, yeah, hop in, you know, like, uh-huh. I would love to give you a ride. And what was just so funny is, like, we had almost been arrested together. So I was supposed to, like, volunteer if you want to be arrested or, like, are willing to be arrested or, you know. And we had done that on the same day. But we were supposed to, like, go into a bank or something and sit down, something like that. And right before I walked in the door, they locked down the bank. So she was arrested that day and I wasn't. Uh-huh. But, like, it was like we were meant to have been in jail together. Uh-huh. And then I was, like, arrested 2 days later. But, like, just that she picked me up on the roadside in Delaware, you know. And then we, like, got to talk for a couple hours. Yeah.
Because Standing Rock is in North Dakota.
Yeah. It was just such a weird serendipitous thing.
I'm going to stop that interview right there. It's about over anyway. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. That was been an interview with Stephanie, who is a house guest of ours last week through Trust Roots, which is a couch surfing kind of organization for hitchhikers and the like. One thing about the story I had told about the Guatemalan guys that had picked me up that I thought were human smugglers, it's that they also let me borrow their cell phone so I could call my dad and meet him at the place on the Kentucky-Tennessee border where they dropped me off. So Democracy Now! Is coming up at 5 o'clock here on Valley Free Radio. Oh, yeah, I was going to play a song, one of my favorite hitchhiking songs by Johnny Cash.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee, Chicopee, Spirit Lake, Grand Lake, Devil's Lake, Crater Lake, the Beach Lake. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Louisville, Nashville, Knoxville, Ombabaka, Shepherdville, Jacksonville, Waterville, Coast, Rocka, Pittsfield, Springfield, Bakersfield, Shreveport, Hackensack, Cadillac, Fond du Lac, Davenport, Idaho, Jellicoe, Argentina, Diamantina, Pasadena, Catalina, see what I mean. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Pittsburgh, Parkersburg, Gravelburg, Colorado, Ellensburg, Rexburg, Vicksburg, Eldorado, Larimore, Atmore, Havistall, Chattanooga, Chaska, Nebraska, Alaska, Opelika, Baraboo, Waterloo, Kalamazoo, Kansas City, Sioux City, Cedar City, Dodge City, what a pity. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been everywhere.
I like that song actually mentions Jellico, Tennessee, because most people haven't heard of it, and that's where the Guatemalan guys dropped me off on the Kentucky-Tennessee line. All right, you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM in Northampton. Democracy Now! Is coming up at 5 o'clock. Another announcement I'd like to make is this Sunday, July 23rd, is the third annual Justice Cup in Holyoke. It's a soccer tournament fundraiser for Jobs with Justice and the Pioneer Valley Workers Center. You can look up Justice Cup 2017, and there's a Facebook page that the Pioneer Valley Workers Center has where there's a link to register. And also, if you want to stay informed about government, well, are you worried about where our government is taking us? Then organize, show up, stay informed, and call your legislators. The U.S. Congressional Switchboard can be reached at 202-224-3121. Put that number in your contacts and use it, 202-224-3121. The prompts will take you to your senators and representatives. And don't forget about the state legislature. I mean, your senators and representative. Don't forget about the state legislature. Check out malegislature.gov to find out who your state senator and state reps are and find out about upcoming legislation and how your legislators have voted in the past. Even better, go visit the offices of your legislators. Gave her life and saved her skin.